Okay, it's time to start. This is the last class of the semester. We're continuing. This is class number 3 on Rav Yitzchak Hanan Spector. Before we start, I want to mention something which is relevant to things we've been doing already. I'm holding in my hand now a reprint from, you can get books printed off Google Books. It's here's the figure. This is Isaac Hirsch Weiss, the author of Dor Dor V'Doroshav, a Haskalah work which really became really one of the most hated works in the yeshiva world. But he also wrote an autobiography, his memoirs. And in here he points out something which is interesting to a number of things we've spoken about. We've spoken in the past about how the job of the rabbi was very different in previous years. Everything that today we expect the rabbi to do, they really didn't do. And on page 54-55, he speaks about how he grew up in Moravia. He studied in all the big cities in Moravia, Nicholsburg and in a number of other places. He speaks about how the job of a rabbi was really very easy. You didn't have much to do. You didn't decide halacha questions, really. He says, you know, if there's a din Torah, if there was a question, you could decide, but you didn't sit on dinei Torah because there was usually dayanim in a significant city. And if there weren't dayanim, he said, there were always talmidei chachamim who could decide it. You didn't teach. What did you do? He says, you sat and learned. And he explains how the people in the community who valued Torah, that's all they wanted from the rabbi also. And he contrasts that to, this is in the mid-19th century, all the things that the rabbis in Germany were required to do to run schools and teach and everything like that. Whereas in Moravia, and we already saw in Lithuania as well, you had none of that. Okay, let's pick up with Rav Yitzchak Hanan Spector. We spent a lot of time last class and we ended that he was on the Beis Din, even though he was quite young, in his 40s, to decide the fate of the Volozhin Yeshiva. He also was called upon to decide the fate of another yeshiva, the Mir Yeshiva, the only two large and old yeshivos where the Volozhin Yeshiva and the Mir Yeshiva, Mir founded in 1815. There was another machokis between the grandson of the... I think it was the son of the founder and the son-in-law of another son who should take over, and one of them was also the Rav of the city. Rav Yitzchak Hanan was also called to be a Rav, be a Dayan on that Beis Din. How they decided who gets what is not so important for us. What is important is that they made a principle that the Rav of the city in Mir should not be the Rosh Yeshiva. Truth of the matter is that in later years, that was not the case, because Rav Eliyahu Kamai and Avram Tzvi Kamai, martyred in the Holocaust, the son of Eliyahu Kamai, who was the Rosh Yeshiva at the turn of the century, the 20th century, he was also the Rav of the city. But usually, the Rav of the city was in yeshivas was not the Rav of the yeshiva itself. There are exceptions, and the Tziv is one. We've spoken of some other exceptions, but usually the yeshiva was independent of the Rav of the city and independent in terms of financial contributions. We'll see in a few minutes about the kollel in Vilna, Rav Eliyahu Baruch Kamai. Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg was a Talmud of his. We're going to see in a few minutes about how the system of sending out Meshulachim, that was a new concept where you see your yeshiva as international. In 1864, Rav Yitzchak Hanan becomes Rav of Kovno. And this was not an easy time to become Rav of Kovno. Kovno was a city full of maskilim. When I say maskilim, for the most part, I mean Shomer Shabbos, observant maskilim. And Kovno remains such a city until the end. If you read my post... on the Sfarim blog, I spoke about the last Rav of Kovno, who was Rav Avram Dov Ber Shapiro. And in the comments, someone points out that Nussan Kamenetsky, in his book, Making of a God, Chodos, he speaks all about how Rabbi Kamps last week, or emailing him with him, he told me something which he said I shouldn't publish, but I think I can repeat it over, that actually he said that he softened this a bit. His father didn't actually say that Kovno got a rabbi who was close to Haskalah. He said that Kovno got a Rav who was a maskil, that the Devar Avram was a maskil. And then he goes on, Rabbi Kamenetsky, his father for him and received smicha from him, etc. But Kovno always had a strong enlightened community, maskilim. We will see soon that Vilna did as well. Rav Yitzhak Ochanan always had good relations, as we'll see, with these religious maskilim. We call them maskilim. Today we would call them, we call them Torah Umada Jews, we call them YU types, but in those days they were called maskilim. These are not maskilim of the sort that you had in Germany or that you would have in Hungary, maskilim who wanted to reject Torah Judaism. These are not maskilim of the sort that you think of, people like Avraham Mapu, or we're going to hear about soon, Yehuda Leib Gordon, not those type. Exactly. Baruch says maskilim mean different things to different people, and we will see in a few minutes that Noah Wessa person and Rabbi Yitzchak Spector is a member of the Haskalah Society in Kovno. So yes, Haskalah means different things to different people. You had extreme, you had radical Haskalah, etc. But there's no question that Kovno was a center of Lithuanian Haskalah, a conservative Haskalah. If you know the names, for example, Rashi Finn in Vilna, you know the Rav Matisyahu Strashun, the son of the Rashash, whose notes, by the way, are in the back of the certain Masechtas, Bab Basra, and I believe a few others. He's a maskil. The Rashash himself is sort of tending to Haskalah. What Haskalah means in that context are Torah Jews who believe in broadening themselves to know science, history, that sort of thing. We're not talking about maskili who want to reject Torah Judaism. So Bill says something interesting, that the Dvar Avraham attacked Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski over his liberal Geirus approach. And that's true. Rav Chaim Ozer held, we spoke about this in the past, that the idea that you can convert someone, even though the person's going to violate mitzvos, and even though the person knows he's going to violate those mitzvos, and even if the person tells you he's going to violate mitzvos, Rav Chaim Ozer says that when it comes to Shabbos, however, Kashrus, that already we can't convert people, but everything else, and even apparently includes Taras Mishpacha in this, perhaps because Taras Mishpacha is a private thing, we can convert them. That new, how can you convert someone? We know that you can't convert someone if they're going to violate mitzvos. You can't convert someone who says, convert me, but with the exception of this. Rav Chaim Ozer says that it depends. If the person has an ideological opposition to a certain mitzvah, then he can't be converted because he's rejecting Torah. But if the person accepts the mitzvos, but simply is like every other Jew, he's going to, we're not going to convert someone if they speak Lashon Hara? Every Jew speaks Lashon Hara. So he says if the person even admits that he's weak and he can't observe everything, that we can convert them. And the Devar Avraham has a tshuva in which he rejects this. The Devar Avraham is not rejecting, the way I read it, the idea that if someone, obviously if someone converts and they sin, they're still Jewish. But if someone from the outset is already telling you before they're converted that I'm weak and certain things, you know, not lahachli, still teyavlo, and I'm not going to, you know, if I'm traveling and there's no kosher food, I might eat, fish out or something like that sort. If it's a shita, that you do it b'shita and you do it even in your home when you can get kosher food. But in the case like where it's just occasionally, Rav Chaim Ozer says it's okay. And the Dvar Avraham says, no, it's not a valid conversion. So Bill says, well, this makes him seem, extreme a bit. And I say no to Bill. And Bill, as a Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik was also, he'd be called the Kovno Rav, who wrote that famous letter about Rav Soloveitchik, how he's the greatest of the generation. Rav Soloveitchik, had Rav Soloveitchik been living in Lithuania, he'd be called a maskil, and he'd be called... He'd be someone just like the Kovno Rav, and Rav Soloveitchik was no Mekil on all sorts of matters. So the fact that someone, just think about Rav Soloveitchik, who you knew, just because someone is open-minded and believes in secular education, all these things, that doesn't mean that halakhically, although generally we might assume that in certain halakhic matters they're being more liberal, and in general Rav Soloveitchik was more liberal than, let's say, a typical post-Sagan B'nai Brak, but on certain areas Rav Soloveitchik was very machmir. On Eiravin, on Geirus, on a host of issues. Rav Kook also, by the way, who's also often regarded as very liberal and open-minded when it came to Geirus, he was very, very machmir. So we can't assume that open-minded poskim are by definition, and take a post-taker of Rav Nasha Klein, who is so extreme and far out there and fanatic in so many ways, when it comes to all sorts of things, he's an incredible, incredible makil. So that's all I would say. So Bill says about Rav Soloveitchik, he had the Kovno, Rav Soloveitchik had the Kovno Rav's view on Geirus. Yeah, I mean, it's known that Rav Soloveitchik was very stringent on conversion in a host of areas. He was stringent. In fact, Rav Chaim Ozer, I don't want to get into it now, but the Rav publicly rejected Rav Dov C. Hoffman's liberal views of conversion. But it is surprising for most people when they first hear that some of these more liberal rabbis are quite stringent. I mean, Rabbi Soloveitchik had a position that can hear Tekiyas HaShofar by going into a shul that's mixed seating. I heard from Rabbi Yehuda Parnas, no liberal, how he didn't understand why, where Rabbi Soloveitchik got this. You know, it's one thing not to daven, but you're gonna not walk in to hear Tekiyas HaShofar. But he says that was the Rav's position, Harah Shai, he thought it was. Rav Herschel Schechter does not have such an extreme position on a number of these matters. So we can't always make a correspondence. Rabbi Professor Michal Nahorai has an article comparing Rav Kook to the Chazon Ish, and in case after case, Rav Kook is more machmir than the Chazon Ish. So in 1864, Rav Yitzchak Chonon becomes Rav of Kovno. The economic situation at this time was actually better than it had been in previous years. Tsar Alexander II had assumed the throne in 1855. This was a great improvement over his father, Tsar Nicholas, who was responsible for the Cantonists and all these other terrible things. And if you read the literature, both the memoir literature and the general historical literature, Tsar Alexander really did want to improve the conditions of the Jews. Not because it would lead them to conversion. He obviously would have liked if Jews convert, but everything Tsar Nicholas did had as its goal to bring about conversion of the Jews. Tsar Alexander really wanted, he had this sort of enlightenment perspective, very similar to what Emperor Joseph II had, Maria Theresa's son, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the idea of civilizing the Jews, bringing civilization to them. So obviously, they have to be modernized, and they have to be brought into the 20th to the 19th century. However, this doesn't mean that they have to convert. That wasn't the goal. It was to modernize them, to civilize them. The problem is, as can be expected, Joseph II ran into the same problem. The Orthodox leaders were in opposition. Now, when you look at what the government wanted, it really is what we have today. And we assume as a matter of course that this is how we should live. Basic secular education for children. We're not talking about advanced education. We're talking about basic in the cheders, which they wanted to revise the cheders, but in the elementary schools, that the children also be given secular education, exactly what Joseph II wanted. Furthermore, Tsar Alexander went even further. He wanted rabbis to be secular educated. We also, at least in the modern communities, want that as well. Although in the mid-19th century, this was a radical position, and we'll see how Yitzchak Chonon dealt with it, today we take it for granted. The problem was with the cheders is that there was no system of education in the cheder. Every country which wants to be a modern liberal country wants to ensure and wants to insist that their children receive secular education. It's a requirement. First of all, it's an economic requirement. You can't have a society if the children don't speak the language. Russian Jews, by the way, the typical Orthodox Jew, traditional Jew in old Russia, did not speak proper Russian. You remember that scene in Fiddler on the Roof? You know, the one guy could read the newspaper. So as the century went on, more and more did. But the rabbis couldn't speak Russian. The average Jew couldn't speak Russian. How can you have a society like that? And many of you spoke Russian. It was just the Russian that they picked up. So you want to educate them. If you're trying to build a society, a country, you want to teach them history of your society. You want to teach them a tree. So you want to create a civilized, advanced society that you can prosper. That's the problem, obviously, today we have in Israel. How can you have a large percentage of the population which has no high school education, no even elementary school education, and therefore cannot be employed? You're losing such an asset in terms of population to grow the country economically. So that's what Tsar Alexander wanted. The problem was that there was no obligatory education. In America, we have obligatory. It's so funny because in Israel, the Haredim shout Shmad, that, you know, because Israel wants to teach, you know, a little bit of mathematics and basic geography and a little language arts to the boys. The girls, it's no problem. For the boys, it's Shmad. And yet in America, even the Satmar and the Bells and all these schools learn these basic things because the government requires it. The truth of the matter is, if Satmar were to sue, they could probably get out of this as well, because there was a Supreme Court case about the Amish. And the Amish was able to get out of government requirements. But no, even the Hasidic schools, sometimes they don't actually follow through on what they're supposed to. But there's even a book called Teacher about a guy, I think he wasn't Jewish even, about his time teaching in the Satmar school system. Obviously, they don't take it seriously, and I'm sure, I don't know if they still have regents, but those were the schools that would give the regents out ahead of time. But in other words, they're able to, I don't see people going off the derech, as they say, because they're forced to take a little bit of American history. Yeah, the problem in Russia was, as far as the Russian government was concerned, that you didn't have a school system. You didn't have a public school system, and you didn't have a school system in which there was any sort of inspection. The cheders were all privately owned. That is, someone would come to town, he'd become a Mohammed, and we know that whereas traditional Judaism has a little bit of protectionism, not a lot of protectionism, but a little bit. I mean, you can open up a pizza shop in the same town as someone else, but you know, the rabbis will not give a hashgacha if you open it up right next door. So there's a little bit of protectionism. So in that case, I guess you have to get a different hashgacha, unless the rabbis determine that there's enough room for both of them. However, when it comes to Limud Torah, we know about Kinat Sofrim that there is no protectionism. It's a complete Milton Friedman free enterprise system. If I'm a Mohammed and there's already another Mohammed there, it doesn't matter. I can put him out of business because that's the system that the rabbis put in place. Okay, before I go further, let me read some of these questions here. Baruch asked a good question. In the Pale, did most Gentiles speak Russian? Well, I think it depends where you're talking about. Jews were living in many places where Russian was the language. Obviously, the further out east you go, they didn't. And in places like Poland, they would have spoken Polish. Of course, the Jews in Poland didn't speak Polish either. The Jews had their own language, their own civilization, and this went on, incidentally, in many places up until World War II among Hasidic Jews. I heard from the son of Rav Shlomo David Kahana, the Rav of Warsaw, and later of the Old City, that he made, this was Shazach, he were Shmuel Zanvel Kahana. He was an Israeli government official. He made money and he told me there were people who used to stay outside the courthouses and government buildings, Jews, whose job it was to translate into Polish, that is proper literary Polish, when they had to fill out forms for the government and everything. No, I do take it seriously. I just said with the book, Teacher. It's just I wasn't sure. I couldn't remember if he was Jewish or not Jewish. And Baruch says, yes, many Gentiles were illiterate. No question about it. The typical Russian peasant living in his shack, living on a dirt floor in a one-room hovel, was illiterate. And all they cared about was the Tsar and the Russian Orthodox Church. But they spoke Russian. Jews were living as a civilization inside another civilization, not just in Russia, in Poland, wherever Jews were. And this was something that wanted to be changed. And so what did they do? They opened up so-called crown schools, sponsored by the government, with strong encouragement for Jews to attend. But very few children attended, and they knew, the government realized they couldn't force them. What are you going to do? There were some, that is, the children of the Maskilim. It's often the case that Rabbi mentioned about Rav Zevin. He said that it's unusual that usually you have the children of Maskilim go even more to the left. But the case of the Marcheshes, Rav Igas's father, who was a real Maskil, his son becomes one of the Gedolei Yisrael. That's not usually the case. Most of the Maskilim, they were the ones who sent their kids to these schools, and but you didn't have the traditional Orthodox, they didn't call them Orthodox, the traditional Torah Jews, they didn't send their kids to the crown school. So how then to create a religious system which would be more sympathetic? Tsar Alexander passed a law that was to begin in 1875 that no one was to be appointed rabbi or teacher in any of these schools, Cheder or anywhere else, unless you were an official crown rabbi, unless you graduated from they opened up two rabbinical seminaries. They tried to get all sorts of Gedolim to teach in these seminaries, one in Vilna, one in Zhytomyr. The seminaries were actually founded earlier in 1847, but when Tsar Alexander passed the rule that no one could serve as a rabbi beginning age 75 unless you were had graduated from one of them. They tried to get Yisrael Salanter to teach there because they thought he would, Maskilim, the instructors became Maskilim. And they were able to get one traditional rabbi who was leaning towards Haskalah. His name was Tzvi Hirsch Katzenellenbogen in Vilna. But he sort of, by doing that, he cut himself off. It's the equivalent of all of people like Shaul Lieberman, who when they went to the seminary, they were then cut off from Torah Judaism. Taking a position in one of the crown rabbinical schools meant you were cut off from, it's like today, if a YU graduate would take a position in a non-machitza shul. It's the same sort of thing. Now, the truth is that the Vilna seminary was much more traditional. Because Vilna, though Vilna was a center of Haskalah, it was a much more conservative Haskalah. Zhytomyr was already, the teachers and the students were not observant. In Vilna, they were more observant. But still, this institution was regarded, rightfully so, as an institution, both of them, both rabbinical seminaries, to undermine traditional Judaism. And Ritz Elchanan was opposed to this and battled with this. And all the rabbis did. We've spoken in the past, however, of what became of these crown rabbis. Actually, let's talk about it in a few minutes when I get to the big dispute between Rabbi Moshe Grzinski and the Chafetz Chaim over the role of the crown rabbi. We've spoken about them many times, but we'll get back to it. In fact, recently I learned. Who did I learn was a crown rabbi? I was surprised. I can't remember now. It's in my mind. If you read my Weinberg book, I could have been Klatskin. Now, I'll mention what this means to be a crown rabbi. I didn't mean that they went through the seminary. We'll get to that in a few minutes. So Rav Yitzchak Elchanan battled against these plans for the seminaries and everything, but that didn't mean he battled all the Maskilim, as I mentioned. He had very good relationships with a number of Maskilim, and as I said at the beginning of tonight, there is a long and strong tradition of Orthodox Haskalah in Lithuania. Rav Yisrael Salanter was also very friendly with Maskilim. That's why they assumed that he could take over the rabbinical seminaries. They were looking for a great name, just like Shaul Lieberman. He asked so many Gedolei Yisrael, including, which is, we have some of you, I think, online here from Forest Hills. He asked Rav Zell Gesty. He asked Rav Hirschsprung. He asked Rabbi Price. He wanted to bring in Gedolei Yisrael there. They also wanted Gedolei Yisrael to take over these rabbinical seminaries to give them the imprimatur. Rav Yisrael, though, differed with Rav Yisrael Chanan. Although they agreed when it came to seminary, they differed in another interesting way. I'll just mention this. Derech Agav, we've spoken in the past how Rav Yisrael Salanter wanted the Talmud to be translated into Russian to teach it at the universities. And the Maskilim also wanted to do this. But Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan had a different perspective on this. He opposed it. And at least so this story is recorded by Rav Baruch Epstein in the Makor Baruch. Usually, those who remember one of my early Svarimbag posts, I don't take what Rav Baruch Epstein says very seriously. Most of what he says, most of the stories he says, I don't believe they're true. Either he made them up or he's just repeating Bava Maisa's. But when he's writing about Rav Yitzchak Elkanan Spector and he's writing about something that people who are alive can remember, and such a significant dispute, you have to assume that he's what he's saying is correct. And the least as he tells the story, the Maskilim came to Rav Yitzchak Elkanan and to get him to agree to translate the Talmud into Russian. You know, there's two aspects here. Rav Yitzchak Elkanan wanted to translate into Russian to get it to be brought into the university. And Rav Yitzchak Elkanan expressed his opposition. He gave them a parable. He said as follows. In a city not far from Kovno, there was a Rav who was a great scholar, but also a very modest person. At the same time, there was someone in another city who was a genius, a gaon, but he didn't take seriously the Talmudic knowledge of any of his colleagues. He belittled them. If it's a true story, I think this Elkanan might be referring to the Ragachavar, because even though the Ragachavar was younger, the Ragachavar mocked Yitzchak Elkanan also. Rav Tzair, in his autobiography, describes how when he went to the Ragachavar mocked Yitzchak Elkanan. He belittled him. So getting back to the story, so this great genius in the parable comes to a neighboring rabbi and wants to make his acquaintance, and he... he sends a messenger, when can I come visit you, Rabbi? And the rabbi, sends back, he can't visit with whatever, he pushes him off, he avoids it. The rabbi was asked by his friends, what's going on here? This great gaon comes to town, he wants to speak to you. And the rabbi replied, I know what gaon pony thinks about me. He thinks I'm a nobody. But that's okay. Because he doesn't know me. And you, my friends, you can always assume that the reason he thinks I don't know anything and I'm a nobody is because he's never met me. I never engage with him in Talmudic discussion. The rabbi speaking, I know the character, however, of this gaon. He doesn't change his mind or alter his opinion. After I meet with him, he's going to speak to me in learning, and he's still going to have the same opinion that I'm a nobody, I'm a nothing. And then what are you going to do, my friends? Because then you can't no longer say that this rabbi, the reason he thinks I'm a nobody is because he's never met me. Now he's met me and he still thinks it. So what's that going to do to your opinion of me? Rav Yitzchak Elkanan said the same thing about the Talmud. He says, now that the non-Jews make fun of the Talmud and mock it and attack it, we can always say that's because they don't know what's in the Talmud. But if we translate it into Russian and then they read it, and they're still going to mock it and oppose it, then we won't have any excuse. Well, we won't be able to say anything anymore. At least now we can tell the good non-Jews. And those Jews who are not learned, we can tell them that, what do you expect the Goyim are going to say? They've never studied it. But if we translate it into Russian, then we lose that ability, because then they all have seen it. And the truth is that this is the reason why the Gedolim uniformly, and I think Yisrael Salanter might even fall into this as well, opposed translating the Agadot. Everyone knows that Yisrael Salanter wanted to translate the Talmud, but I think that's probably just the Halachot. I'll have to check on that. But we have responsa by rabbis, Gedol Yisrael, including the Ragachover, by the way, in which they're very opposed to translating the Talmud. Not the Halacha, really, but the Agadata. The Agadata has always been a focus, first of non-Jewish mocking, of apostates, and later the Maskilim. The Maskilim focused on the Agadata to attack it, to show that the Jews are simpletons. And this isn't, by the way, a new thing. If you know the Rambam speaks about three approaches to Agadata. One is that people take it literally, everything literally. The other approach is to mock it. So we see already in the days of the Rambam, people are mocking it. And why do they mock it? They mock it for good reason, according to the Rambam. Because they mock it because they see the people around them who take it literally. So of course they mock it, and they should mock it, because it's not supposed to be taken literally, and it's making it to be Zion to the Torah to take it literally. The Rambam says the true way to understand Haggadah, Haggadah are secrets, and therefore you have to understand that there's divine truths and philosophical truths in the Haggadah. So the first two are disgraceful, because they each one of them degrade the Torah, either by taking the Haggadot literally, or by rejecting the Haggadot. And the only way is you have to take it to know that the Haggadot have meanings beyond the simple meaning. But as I said, the very fact that the Rambam in the Middle Ages is talking about people who mock the Haggadot shows that this is already something that goes back very far. Non-Jews have really two approaches to Haggadot. One is to mock it, to make fun of it. The other approach is to use the Haggadot. If you recall the vikuach, the disputation between Pablo Christiani and the Ramban, Nachmanides, Pablo Christiani tries to show that you can show the truth of Jesus through the Haggadah. And this becomes a theme among in other polemics, that because you have all sorts of passages, strange passages, that the Messiah is born the day the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, or is that what it says? I forget the Lashon. But you have all sorts of, or that in the days of the Messiah, the commandments will be abolished, you won't need to do mitzvos, all sorts of strange things like this, that if you want to distort it, you can use the Haggadot to support Christianity. If anyone's interested, this idea hasn't even ended. Just plug in Rav Kaduri, Christianity. There's a whole group of Christians that believe that the late Mekubal, Rav Yitzhak Kaduri, was a closet Christian, because he wrote some... not a Kamea, but like a very obscure text towards the end of his life. In fact, he might have even been the only open after he died, in which they read Christological things into it. So it's an old scheme by the missionaries. Yecheskel says, what about Ein Davar Yotze Midei Pshuto? For the Rambam, you have to understand what that means. It doesn't mean Agarita. On the contrary, by definition, it's not a garita. He's talking about that means pshat, that pshat in chumash, where you can interpret it all sorts of ways. But when it comes to a garita, for the Rambam, there's two problems. It's not just that, and I don't know which is more important. Literal interpretation of Haggadah isn't just a disgrace to the Torah, because it makes the Torah into something foolish. I mean, talking about people who... Adam HaRishon, you know, giants and all, you know, all crazy miracles. That's one thing. But the other part is, when you take it literally, you destroy the whole point of Haggadah. So it's not just that you you disgrace the Haggadah and make the rabbis into laughing stocks, which is exactly what the Christians took the Haggadah and turned into a laughing stock, but you miss the whole point of the Haggadah, in that the Haggadah has divine truths, has philosophical truths below the surface. And therefore, it's not enough that you make it into a laughing stock. You miss the whole point that philosophy is essential to the Torah. And philosophy is couched in these agadic statements. And if you read the Moreh Nevuchim, and you see the Rambam will cite Haggadot. Now, this doesn't mean, though, that the Rambam takes every Haggadah. On the contrary, the Rambam rejects certain Haggadot. He states explicitly, for example, in his letter on astrology, that one of the options when dealing with astrology, since he rejects that, is that we reject certain rabbis. The truth is hidden from them. So the Rambam and his son, Rav Avraham ben Rambam, if you read his introduction, they do not accept every Haggadah. However, there are some Haggadot that can be rejected, but the idea of Haggadah and the fact of many Haggadot is that they come with important philosophical truths. By the way, the Ramban, in his Vikuach, he's confronted with these statements that go against the narrative that he wants to present. So he also says that Haggadot are like sermons. They're, you know, you take what appeals to you, and what doesn't appeal to you, it's no big deal. You don't need to follow it. And that, by the way, this position is found already among the Gaonim, Rav Haigon, Rav Shira Gaon, Shmuel ben Chafni, and others. But when it comes to the Ramban, there's a big debate whether this is to be taken literally, because the Ramban was a Mekubal. And according to some, if you're a Mekubal, that means that every Haggadah has to have significance. Obviously not literal significance, but it has to have some significance, like the Maharal and others showed, and therefore it is incomprehensible to them that the Ramban would have ever said, would have ever meant that, nah, I got doubt. If it appeals to you, fine. If it doesn't appeal to you, I don't need to accept it. See, when he says, I don't accept that I got doubt, Papa Christiani gets all upset. He says, you see, he's rejecting their holy scriptures. And the Ramban says, no, this is Agadah, it's not holy scripture. So some say that Nachmanides could not have meant that, that this was just, as Daniel Asker once told me, all is fair in love and polemics. There's a whole tradition how in polemics, Jews sort of go close to the line of truth or even say things that aren't true. There's a tradition that in polemics, and when dealing with non-Jews, you don't need to be entirely truthful. And Rav Moshe Feinstein said that the greatest proof of this is the beginning of every Sefer. When you turn the second page, every Sefer published in Europe said that all the things about non-Jews said in this book are not mentioned with regard to the non-Jews we live among. It's only the pagans in China and India. And everyone knew that's false. So that's the proof that in these sort of polemical environments, you can say things that aren't 100% true. Others said that, no, the Ramban, what he said is 100% correct. He meant it. However, he was only referring to Agadot in Midrash. But Agadot in the Talmud, they have a much higher status, and he never would have rejected it. And others, and this includes my teacher, Professor Bernard Septimus, he has a long essay on this, he believes that no, if you look at the Ramban's commentary on Torah, you see the exact same approach, that Agadot need to be taken very seriously, but we are not bound by Agadot, no matter where they appear. Yocheskel asks, that's what I said. Yeah, there's always, that's, but if you take a look at the Chakira article by Rabbi Eisen, Chaim Eisen, he makes the point that really it's only with the Maharal and subsequent that he thinks the Maharal is really the originator of this idea that all Agadot have significance, and if they don't have apparent significance, they have esoteric significance. He claims that this is not the medieval view. It's obviously not the Gaonic view. He says this is also not the medieval view. The idea that all Agadot, he thinks this is an innovation of the Maharal, and he's a big fan of the Maharal. I'm not convinced of that. Although I don't see any positive evidence, per se from Rashi, when you read Rashi, I don't get the sense that Rashi felt that certain Agadot you can just reject. Yes, you find that among the Spanish Rishoni, people like Ibn Ezra, who will reject Agadot. Where do you find this among people in the French schools? You find some, I know, but the people like Rashi and granted, Rashbam apparently felt that he could reject Agadot, but when you read Rashi, I take that back. Now I'm thinking of it, there are certain Agadot in Rashi where he'll quote, and I'll say, but that's not just an Agadah. It's almost like he's poo-pooing it. So maybe Eisen's right. It's been a while since I read the article, but that's Chaim Eisen's point, that this is really an innovation of the Maharal, which then is taken, I think the Grub probably follows it as well, that all Agadot have significance. It's explicitly not the viewpoint of the Gaonim. And, I've written about this on the Svarim blog, you have certain Agadot, for example, fallen angels. The whole idea of fallen angels, mentioned in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, this goes against certain basic doctrines that the Rambam thought were Ikari Amunah, the idea that angels can rebel against God and things like that. So it's hard. And the Chassel says the Bali Musar would take Agadot and drive Musar concepts from them, 100%. How you view Agadot comes into play. What do you do with a book like Louis Ginsberg's book, Legends of the Jews? Can you refer to certain Agadot as legends? Whereas among the more, I guess, modern German Orthodox type, it was very common to speak about certain Agadot as legends. And Isaiah de Rossi, he's really the first one to systematically speak about this. And the famous one he deals with is Titus, how Titus died because the gnat bore into his head and killed him. So the Maharal and others will see this as symbolic. What does this mean? Isaiah de Rossi, no, just like the rabbis weren't experts in science, they took the most advanced science of their time. So too, in certain historical things, their job, their ikar task was Torah. And historical things, they took whatever they heard, whatever was in the air, and therefore they heard a story about Titus. They repeated it. So it's a legend, and legends legends, folklore, etc., are incorporated into the Agadah. I think this is a big distinction between the modern Orthodox and the more right-wing Orthodox. Daniel Sperber, for instance, wrote a whole book about folklore in the Agadot. Modern Orthodox types will identify folklore and legends in the Agadah, whereas the more traditionalist segments following in the Maharal, I will see that as almost even blasphemous to speak that way. But it has a tradition going back all the way to the Gaonim. Let's go on. The institution of crown rabbis becomes the law. It becomes the law in the 1870s, and until the fall of the Tsar, every single rabbi in the Russian Empire had to be a crown rabbi. Now, that doesn't mean that they had to graduate from the rabbinical seminaries, because the rabbinical seminaries would later be closed down, they became teachers' institutes, but they had to pass the test. They had to get the equivalent of a high school diploma. Every rav had to be this way. So now you're going to say, well, wait a second, I know about certain great rav, Chaim Brisker, Chaim Soloveitchik, he was the rabbi in Brisk. Brisk is in the Russian Empire. What type of education did he have? He certainly was not a crown rabbi. And you can go down the list. Kovno also had the rabbi was there was not a, the rav. We think it was not a crown rabbi. Ritzelchan wasn't. What happened was there developed in Russia a system of a dual rabbinate, just like we have the dual Torah, the Torah Shabbat, Torah Shabbatav. There is the dual rabbinate, the spiritual rabbis and the official rabbis, the crown rabbis, the government rabbis. What was the job of the old rabbi, the traditional rabbi, the only rabbi that the people cared about and looked up to? The same job rabbi has had for millennia, to decide halacha questions, to be the postsake. What was the job of the official rabbi who was required, and his salary was paid from the community? He had to record all the weddings, all the funerals, all the births. He had to write up this documentation in Russian. He had to give a report every year to the local governor of what's doing in the community. Basically, he was a functionary. No one took him seriously. Yes, he had a rabbinical ordination from a seminary, in later years, he received a smicha. He even received a smicha in later years when the seminaries closed. But then he took a secular degree. He went to a secular school, and he could be appointed out as a functionary. So no one cared about him, and you think of all the great rabbonim in cities like Brisk. Brisk had a crown rabbi. I forgot his name, actually. But in the discussions of Brisk, sometimes he's mentioned. But he's a nobody, a functionary. Often, not always, but often they were Shomer Shabbos and everything. They were just doing a job. It's like today in New York, there's a job to be the kosher inspector. Does anyone, I think the whole thing I mentioned before is nonsense, is a waste of taxpayer money. This whole thing, none of us, we've had kashrus before in New York State, and we're going to have it after. But New York State Department of Agriculture pays for a guy, although it was, I don't know what they're doing now, because it was ruled unconstitutional, but for a long time, they had a guy who would go and investigate kashrus. No one who took kashrus seriously ever cared about this. We would never eat in a place that was inspected by the New York Department of Agriculture, but it's a functionary, it's a job. A few Jews are making a living. The problem was that many small towns didn't have a lot of money, as you can imagine. And therefore, in order for them to pay for a spiritual rabbi, that is the real rabbi, and also they'd have to pay for the crown rabbi, that was too much for them. Where are they going to get the money for this? These people were dirt poor. Therefore, for the smaller towns, it became desirable, and they actually wanted rabbis, traditional spiritual rabbis, who were also able, who had secular education, who knew Russian, and therefore could pass the examinations, and they could serve as both the crown rabbi and the spiritual rabbi. This would save the community a lot of money, and this, by the early 20th century, this becomes a career path for people coming out of Sabbatka and other places. If you want to make your chances better of getting a position, pass the, get your gymnasium certificate, because therefore you can be an official crown rabbi. That's why Rabbi Chiyakov Weinberg becomes a crown rabbi. That's why so many others become crown rabbis because you didn't have to know a lot. You basically just had to know the equivalent of a high school diploma. And Rabbi Weinberg was tutored on his own. He was taught and he learned and he passed the exams. He went to, I forget where he went to, Minsk, I think it was, to take the exam or, it's on his curriculum vitae, where he says where he did this. And therefore, so many of the Gedolei Yisrael in the early 20th century also were crown rabbis. Because it was just a way of getting, when I say Gedolei Yisrael, they didn't become Gedolei Yisrael, Rav Leo Klatskin. Who's greater than Rav Leo Klatskin? He was a crown rabbi also. It didn't mean anything. All it meant was you didn't need to pay someone else's salary. Now, can you imagine any of our communities, a rabbi who doesn't speak the language? We're not living in Kiryas Yoel here. A rabbi who doesn't have basic knowledge to interact. So that's how, that was the new generation of rabbis. In the hagiography on the Chafetz Chaim, it's called Bishvilei Radin, it reports that there was a dispute in this matter between Reb Chaim Soloveitchik on the one side and Reb Chaim Ozer and the Chafetz Chaim on the other. Actually, before I said the Chafetz Chaim was on a different side, no. The Chafetz Chaim is on Reb Chaim Ozer's side. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik thought that the crown rabbi should be a complete ignoramus. And we should insist that the crown, that every city have a spiritual rabbi and also have a crown rabbi who just knows nothing. Doesn't even need to know Hebrew. Just a functionary. Rav Chaim Ozer and the Chafetz Chaim, however, thought that he should be a Lamdan. That the best thing was, if you recall in our classes on Rav Meir Simcha, we spoke about this as well, where Rav Meir Simcha had a dispute with the Chafetz Chaim about secular education and the rabbi, which Chafetz Chaim didn't want any. But for the crown rabbinate, the Chafetz Chaim thought, we're told, and Rav Chaim Ozer, that although you're still the spiritual rabbi, the crown rabbi at least should be learned. The problem was, sometimes you had these crown rabbis who if there was a large enough Haskalah irreligious following, they thought that they were more than a functionary, and they could take certain steps that would be negative for Torah Judaism, so at least if the crown rabbi was a Lamdan, a Shtika Lamdan, he would know his place and he would respect the tradition. It turned out that in the end, and those who weren't in our class, weren't here for the classes under Chaim Ozer, you can go back and listen to them. In the end, this was Rav Chaim Ozer's undoing. Because the very rabbi, crown rabbi, that he supported, that he backed, that he stood behind, Rabbi Yitzhak Rubinstein, who was a Lamdan, in fact, a significant Lamdan, who comes to power as crown rabbi with the support of Rav Chaim Ozer, he becomes Rav Chaim Ozer's undoing because after World War I, the people vote him in as official rabbi. So I guess Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was right, at least in that case. What's interesting, and I'll mention it again because I don't know how many of you were with us when we did Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski, that in the dispute between Rubinstein and Rav Chaim Ozer, we have really the paradigm of the modern rabbinate. The old-fashioned Rav, Rav Chaim Ozer, just a spiritual rabbi, or the modern rabbi, Rav Yitzhak Rubinstein, who was very involved in political things, who was a social worker, as it were, because during World War I he was so involved. He did all, and truthfully, in the modern Orthodox world, what do we look for when we hire a rabbi? If a rabbi comes to your community, you're looking for a rabbi, and he's the biggest lamdan, and he's published some Sfarim, but he's not a good speaker, and he maybe isn't such a good communicator with people, and you don't think he's going to be so good in the pastoral sense, you're not going to hire him. Because, you know, let's be realistic. In our communities, the attitude is, so if the guy doesn't know every last Tosfos in Bava Basra, that's not what we need. That's exactly what the people in Vilna said. Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski, a great gadol, he's a great posig. That doesn't mean you have to be our Rav, though. If we have a question, we'll go to Rabbi Chaim Ozer. But we don't want him as our Rav. He's a functionary of Chaim Ozer. They turned exactly around. It used to be the crown rabbi was the functionary, and the spiritual rabbi was the Rav. Now they said, no, Rav Chaim Ozer, he'll be the functionary. If I want to know if this is kosher, if the milk spoon falls in the fleishik, I'll go down the street and I'll ask the dayan. But for a rav, no, for a rav, I want to have someone who's a speaker and et cetera, et cetera. And if you look today, England announced a new chief rabbi. Did they hire an old-fashioned rav, one who's a lamdan, who's writing svarim? No. They hired a Rabbi Yitzhak Rubinstein type. They hired someone who's going to speak to the English people. This is Rabbi Mervis. He's going to do what Sachs and what Jacobovitz and all of them done. And with the exception of the first chief rabbi, the Nassim Alger, Rabbi Nassim Adler. We're going to talk about the chief rabbinate of England in the next class when we deal about the great kosher dispute that Rabbi Yitzhak was involved with. So it's quite ironic that all of our modern Orthodox communities today model themselves on the post-World War I Vilna rabbinate, which is a rejection of the traditional rabbinate. We want a social worker, a communicator, one who's good with the kids. And I'm not saying this is wrong. In our communities, I think it's probably much more important to have that than to have someone who is a big Talmud Chacham. I mean, we want someone that the kids look up to and et cetera, et cetera. But we should be aware of the fact that in our communities, we over and over again follow the model that created so much controversy, which is the modern rabbinic model, really emblematic through the life of Rabbi Yitzhak Rubinstein and the great dispute in Vilna. Okay, a few more questions before we go on. No, it was not, but it is because Rabbi Yitzhak Rubinstein was the crown rabbi of Vilna. Baruch Es, I have to repeat it for the people listening on MP3. Vilna in the interwar period was not Tsarist Russia, so is the comparison exact. Yitzhak Rubinstein was the crown rabbi in Vilna from before, during the Tsarist time, before World War I. And he came to that position with the support of Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski. And throughout all of his time as crown rabbi, Rabbi Rubinstein was very respectful of Rav Chaim Moser, and he knew his place. What happened was, after World War I, when there was independent Lithuania, independent Poland, it was part of Poland then, right? I forget now. Well, yeah, it went back and forth. I forget exactly what it was immediately. But when it was independent, then the community wanted to have a new system, and they wanted to have elections. And although Rav Chaim Moser had been the unofficial Rav of Vilna, they said, now we're going to appoint a new Rav. Now, it became more problematic because during World War I, Rav Chaim Moser fled Vilna, and Rabbi Rubinstein stayed in Vilna, even though it was a very difficult time. So they thought, this is the sort of rabbi we need. So the comparison is really the same, because when they come back, you have Rabbi Rubinstein, who was the crown rabbi and was recognized before the war as really just a functionary, although in World War I he had shown great leadership, and Rav Chaim Moser, who was the great postsaik. And now, when they're having an official rabbinic election, who are we going to have? The crown rabbi Rubinstein or Rabbi Chaim Moser? Can anyone check? I forget now. Where? What is Vilna? Is Vilna Poland or is Vilna... I'll check this. I'll check this later. I believe Vilna is... is Vilna's Poland. Yeah, Shulis is Vilna's Poland. Kovno remains Lithuania. Then Vilna becomes Soviet territory. But even when it was none of the people there in Vilna ever regard themselves as having any connection to Poland. Let us go on. We have 5 more minutes. Rav Yitzhak Chanan, I don't need to say, it won't be surprising to anyone, was a big opponent, obviously, to this whole system, as I mentioned, the whole system of the Jewish education. He used his influence with the Maskilim to abolish these decrees that you need to have crown rabbis, unsuccessfully. But the seminaries were closed in 1873 and became Jewish teacher training institutions. Now, let me go back for a minute for Rav Yitzhak Chanan becoming Rav in Kovno. Why did he become Rav in Kovno? What opened up? Who died to make him? Well, it turned out that no one died. There was a great dispute in Kovno. Rabbis always have had disputes. And Rav Yehuda Leib Diskin, who was the Rav in Kovno, had left. He actually was in a dispute with a wealthy family that was using their influence with the government. So when he left, it opened up, and And at this time, in the mid-19th century, they were not looking for someone who was, you know, who was a Maskil, but someone who was at least somewhat open-minded. And while in Kovno, that's when Rav Yitzchak Elkanan becomes the Posek Hador. This phrase we use, for those who weren't here in the first class, Posek Hador in the Lithuanian, Russian, Polish world. The Hungarians never regarded him that. Obviously, the Sephardim never regarded him that. You always have to take these expressions with a grain of salt, because there's at least a few Posek Hadors in every generation. Although I'll tell you that the expression was never used before, I think, two generations ago. We use it now to describe Rav Yitzchak Elkanan Spector. In his lifetime, he never was referred to as the Posek Hador. He wasn't referred to after that. Chaim Moser was never referred to this. This really, I believe this is all political. I think when Agudas Yisrael gets going, they want to show that their Gedolim are greater than the other Gedolim, so they start referring to certain figures as Maran. If you know today how Yateg Ne'eman works, there's only one or maybe two Marans. And if you're given the title Maran, then you're elevated to a certain height. When Rav Avadi Yosef, when the Shas party was in line with Rav Shach, he was referred to as Maran. Posek Hador, so Rav Yashiv is a Posek Hador. So that means that all the other poskim, they're poskim, but they disagree with Rav Yashiv. Their opinions have to be discounted because there's only one Posek Hador. The problem, obviously, is that the Sephardim, Shas party, they call Rav Avadi the Posek Hador. So you have two. What do you do when two Posek Hador give different opinions? It's like the immovable object meets the unstoppable force. But he was the Posek Hador, Rav Yitzchak Elkanan, if you think about it, in terms of his influence, that he was, this doesn't mean that like today, the Haredim today wanted all the other Poskim to back down if Rav Yashiv said that. No, you never had that, and no one even expressed that notion. But Rav Yitzchak Elkanan was of the sort that his opinion was regarded as authoritative by almost everyone, and among the masses, certainly, and almost all the other poskim. And for just about everyone, once he gave a decision, this would be enough for everyone else to fall in line, with certain limited exceptions. That is, before he gave it, it remains a dispute. When Rav Yitzchak Elkanan, we'll see the most famous being the Heter Mechira, but there's others, Shlomo says Rav Moshe was one. Rav Chaim Moser Brzezinski was one. I don't know if Rav Moshe was one. Rav Moshe in America was definitely the Posek Hador, but in Israel, he never really was. He reached a level, he was one of two, or three, I guess you could say, but in Israel, it was always different. In America, he was the Posek, without exception. Undisputed. Obviously, undisputed. I'm not talking about Satmar and the rest of them. In Israel, his authority was, I don't think, for instance, that his authority ever eclipsed that of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, even though he was of a different, older than Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. I don't think, people in the Tzitz Eliezer and others, I don't think they ever regarded themselves, they were never cowed and thought that they had to give in to what Rav Moshe, that's my sense. One of the reasons he becomes known as the Posek Hador is because of, obviously because of his psukim, but his psukim dealing with Agunot. When we return in next semester, we'll talk a little bit about Agunot. He was called the father of Agunot. If I'm not mistaken, the one to call him this was Rav Tzair, Chaim Chernovitz. Next class, I'll make a note for myself. I have to show you some pictures of Rav Tzair and talk about who Rav Tzair, Chaim Chernovitz, was. But he gave a famous hesped, Rav Tzair. At the time, he was at the Kollel in Kovno at the time, and he gave a hesped. And I think that's where the term comes from. I think he's the first one to use it, the father of Agunot. So it's already 10 o'clock, so we'll have to start. There's a lot to do when we pick up next time, next semester. First, some of his psukim. I don't want to get into it, but a little bit about the Aguna. But then, so many more things about the Kollel in Kovno, his role, the Kashrus dispute I mentioned in London, some very interesting psukim of his, and his influence, his important role, and So there's still at least two or three more classes we will have about Rav Yitzchok and Spector. When we next class, when we deal with the Kashrus in London, I will show you, I know you're going to find this hard to believe, but pretty much every kosher butcher in London was selling non-kosher meat under the authority of the chief rabbinate. And the chief rabbinate acknowledged that virtually every butcher in London was selling non-kosher meat. So we'll see how Rav Yitzchok Elchanan comes in to defend the chief rabbinate and to defend their kashrus. So if that's not enough of a hook to get you to be with us next semester, how the Gadol Hador, Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector, could defend a system in which the chief rabbinate of England acknowledged that most butchers, the overwhelming majority, were selling non-kosher meat, and yet they still had hashgacha on them. There's a catch. All will be explained. The truth of the matter is that most butchers in America were also selling non-kosher meat, as we will see. And what do I mean by non-kosher meat? I'll take some questions now. Why do you think, why you named it rabbinical seminary after Rav Yitzchok Elchanan? Because Rav Yitzchok Elchanan recently passed away, and Rav Yitzchok Elchanan was the leading Torah scholar in the Lithuanian Torah world. And YU is a Lithuanian Torah institution. If YU was a, it wasn't YU then, but if this was a Hasidic institution, obviously they would have. But this was a Lithuanian Torah institution, and who was the greatest Rav of the time? Rav Yitzchok Elchanan. A better question is, why was Chaim Berlin named after Chaim Berlin? Because Chaim Berlin was hardly the greatest Rav of the generation, and was hardly the greatest, you know, when Chaim Berlin was appointed by his father to take over, not to take over, to give shiurim while the Nitziv was still there, the students revolted. They didn't think highly enough of him. And Rav Chaim Berlin, the great Talmud Chacham, far be it from me to say otherwise, but we're not talking about someone who was... His reputation increases when he goes to the land of Israel, but we're not talking about the greatest sage of the generation. I will tell you that for Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector, he was the greatest sage, as we were speaking. So who else to name the yeshiva after, if not Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector? There was no connection to him in the sense that the yeshiva, well, he taught at the yeshiva or anything like that. No, this is an American institution, but in looking for a name, you give enough money, you can have the name changed. Probably be 50, 60 million to get the name of Yeshiva changed. That's why. We spoke when we dealt in the classes with the Or Sameach. We spoke about why it was called Or Sameach. I raised the question, why would a Baal Tshuva Yeshiva in the late 19th, 20th century, or the last quarter of the 19th century, out of all the great figures to name it after, you could name it Yeshivas Achiezer of Chaim Moser, you could name it after so many Gedol Yisrael, you could name it after, why name it after the Or Sameach? What does he have to do? And someone had an answer that there was some connection by one of the founders of it, but it needs to be explained, obviously. Why did RJJ name itself after RJJ? Obviously RJJ, because RJJ... This is an American yeshiva, RJJ, and Rav Yaakov Yosef is the great American Rav, the chief rabbi of New York, the Torah scholar brought in from Vilna to be a Rav, so they wanted to give the honor of RJJ. He's an American, though. If Rav Yaakov Yosef was in Vilna, they never would have named the yeshiva after him. The Chiddush is Chaim Berlin. Rav Chaim Berlin was not in America. If he had been in America, if there was some connection... Yeah, Chavetz Chaim already has a connection. Now, the yeshiva itself has a connection to the Chavetz Chaim. So we hear that Revel's father is buried next to him. I did not know that. There's a site, kvarim.org or .net, in which you get pictures of all the great rabbis buried in America, and you'll have Revel's. But you're telling me then Revel's father? What do you mean? Revel's father was buried next to him? But that's afterwards, I guess. I don't even know whether it was named Ritzel Chanan before Revel comes in on the scene, right? I have not been to Rav Yitzchok Elchanan's grave. I have never been to Kovno. So every time I'm going to Eretz Yisrael, God willing, next week, so as you know, I mentioned it, I'm going on this trip, I'm doing Spain. but I haven't been to Kovno. I now want to go to Königsberg, but Königsberg is part of is Russia now, because a couple of years ago they found Rav Yisrael Salanter's grave. It was missing for a long time. If you've been to any of these old cemeteries, you know that they become overgrown. You can't read the Matseva anymore. But they found it and they redid it. I have a problem going to these Russia. I don't have safe for this though. That's why I haven't gone to any of these. Even in Russia, I haven't gone to all these places. Forget about Lithuania, elsewhere. I'm always nervous about driving around those places. Yes, Rav David Leib of Baruch is speaking about. I wrote my post on the Sfarim blog years ago. Plug in rabbis and communism, you'll see my post. After that post, I was told by, I believe it was Nassim Kamenetsky, I have it in my notes, that one of the reasons they didn't like Rav David Leibowitz is that there was accusations against him that he was a communist. Anyone I've told this to has found it strange, because well, why would anyone assume that? But that's what he says, that they thought he was a radical. Bernard Revel was himself, when he was in Tells, he got in trouble for revolutionary activities. He was involved with communists. Oh, so Baruch says that when they wrote, name the yeshiva or Sameach, they were not naming it after the figure, they were naming it after Happy Light. Maybe. However, when I asked this question, one of the people, I don't know if you're on with me now, said absolutely not, said that there is a reason, and they gave the reason. I don't know if this is the real reason or just the Baba Meister, but they gave the reason, the connection to one of the people who founded the yeshiva, to Rav Meir Simcha. He was a fan of the Sefer or something like that. I don't know. Okay, so we... But Baruch, I have to check. I believe the yeshiva was named, it was first named Eitz Chaim. I think they named it to Rav Yisrael Chanan before Revel came to the yeshiva. That's my Revel. No, I'm not going to Kovno. Anyone, you know, we have a number of people already signed up for my Central Europe trip. The Italy trip just went online, so I think we only have two signed up for it now. Anyone who knows someone who wants an interesting Torah history trip, also general history, we see all the general sites, definitely let them know about this. Yeah, Baruch, what you say is correct. It's probably just a crazy story. Yeah, the name predates Dr. Revel. Okay, I'll take two more minutes of comments and questions. Rav Yitzchak Chanan and the yeshiva, from its very beginnings, before it was always a Lithuanian yeshiva. And I think a number of you listening here know who the first graduate person of the old predated Rav Yitzchak Chanan, you know, when it was Eitz Chaim, on the 100th anniversary of YU. They wanted, you know, and its predecessors, they were trying to, their bill has it. They wanted to honor the oldest graduate. And this story is told in the introduction to Gurak and Schachter's book. Some enterprising official at the public relations department came up with a great idea. Find the oldest graduate. And lo and behold, when they found out it was Mordechai Kaplan, they figured, well, we have to postpone this celebration. And they did. 10 years later, I think it was 10 years later, they did honor the oldest graduate, and Mordechai Kaplan was no longer among the living then, but that would have been a little too embarrassing to honor Mordechai Kaplan as the oldest graduate. Okay, Baruch asks, we'll take a couple more, when the next Sfarim Block post will be up. It's done. But the truth of the matter is, I don't know if I'm going to get a chance to read it over. I want to add a few more things. I'm going to try to get to it for the next couple of days, but I don't get a chance to check it when I'm in Europe, and I don't like to have it up if I can't check it to respond. Although, if you've noticed, we used to get 70, 80, 90 comments on these. One of mine got like 300 comments. This new system they have, which is a pain in the neck to do comments on. First of all, they don't show up immediately, and you have to log in. I'm going to try to have them change this system, because more people than ever are reading it, but... In fact, I was a little upset because today some of you probably saw the interesting post by Ashal Magid in the Tablet all about the president of Yale's forebear, Eliel Tzvi Soloveitchik. There's no mention of the fact that on the Svarim blog, I wrote a whole piece about Eliel Tzvi Soloveitchik. I even used that picture. So maybe Shaul doesn't read it, but most of the academics read it. Yes, I will be at the Van Leer Institute speaking. Just a short talk on the Stipor. Those who heard my talks here, there's a conference at the Van Leer Institute. For me, it's a free chance to go to Israel. So whenever I have that, I go, especially I have a kid who's in Israel now. There's a conference on, quote, ultra-Orthodoxy. So all the papers are about ultra-Orthodoxy, and don't just think this is going to be us academic types there. You will have in the audience guys with beards and payas. I mean, there's a whole group of intellectuals in the so-called ultra-Orthodox Haredi world who are very interested in these sorts of things. Benny Brown, for instance, is going to be there, and many, many others all speaking on the topic. Yes, and Van Leer puts the talks online. I will tell you, at Chatai Ani Maskir, only two of us are speaking in English. Sam Heilman, see about his reception, and myself. Even Yoel Finkelman, I mean, he's American, but he's lived in Israel enough years. I could definitely do the paper in Hebrew. The problem is, I don't read papers. My papers are sort of like what I do here. I have notes and I speak extemporaneously, which is good or bad. At least I'm not looking down at the paper. I'm looking at the people and, things come to my mind. The problem is I don't think I could do it extemporaneously before Israeli academics. I could not speak proper Hebrew, academic, highfalutin Hebrew, extemporaneous. To read it, that's not a problem, obviously. But to do it extemporaneously, I don't feel comfortable doing it, and I don't want to be embarrassed by making some mistakes, and therefore I will be reading in English, but they all know English, so look, when they come to America, we have conferences, we let them do it in Hebrew, so I don't feel so embarrassed that, I have to do it in English. And no one's speaking in Yiddish. You're right, someone should speak in Yiddish, what can we say? Yeah. That would be good. If David Katz, Baruch, if your friend David Katz was there, we'd speak in Yiddish. That would be good. Okay, everyone. Thank you all for coming. It was a very nice semester. Let me repeat once again, like it says in the sages tell us that you learn a lot from your teachers and more from your colleagues, but most from the students. So you all of you, some of you who know many more things about lots of things than me, but at least for this hour, I'm the teacher and you're the student, but I learn more from you than from anyone else because your questions, your comments, your corrections, I have to give a special high five to Baruch and also Shlomo, others as well. Always keep me on my toes if I think I can come in here. And I will tell you, though, in my defense, 99.9% of the little errors, the things I misspeak, the wrong dates, those are the extemporaneous things. So I should be careful now because you're right. Van Leer puts it on YouTube. So I don't want to be so extemporaneous that I say something and then it's on YouTube forever and, I gave the wrong city or something like that. But among friends like we are, it's all good. So thank you again and God willing, hope to see you in the new secular year when we start again. Good night, everyone.